up, speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, January 19th. It's foggy day out there in Vancouver, especially if you're close to the water or low down. Are you close enough to hear the foghorns in the morning?
No. No, I hear the trains at night.
Okay.
But, you know, they're quite loud when you take, you know, I take SkyTrain and you're on the Sapperton station.
Yeah.
And during the day they'll have, and it can be very loud, the train thing. It sort of seems rather romantic hearing it the way that they sound at night, because I'm at Lougheed Mall area. But when you're right there, it's really loud, too loud, the train sounds.
Well, down by the water, everybody's been hearing the foghorns sounding in the mornings, as we've had pretty heavy fog in on the water around the harbor here in Vancouver. And any ship that's moving on the water has to be sounding its foghorn at least every 2 minutes, and typically more like every minute. So you do hear it. Some people complain. I guess if you're close enough, maybe it really does wake you up. I love the sound of the foghorns.
Well, I got up about 15 after 8. And I saw it was outside ever since then, and we didn't have fog around Lougheed Mall, and then went up there on the bus and didn't see any fog today.
All right, my name is Magnus Teevil. Joining me in the studio today is
Peter R. H.
And we got a good show for you lined up today. We're going to talk a bit about the U.S. and Greenland for a few moments here at the beginning. Then we have a special episode. It's part of a series, a six-part series, produced by SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, or the SVSPO, a six-part series called Healing Together. And we're going to listen to one of those episodes this morning. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. And then, Peter, what are you talking about today?
Well, I'm going to talk about, remember Megyn Kelly?
Yeah, she's still on the air down there.
On a podcast, here I got from 10 years ago, the book, when she was supposed to have stopped Trump. Remember that? That was the thing 10 years ago.
Was it? Oh, now she's very much a Trump apologist.
I know, but no. Quite seriously, remember she made the comment 10 years ago, or not quite 10 years ago now, about that he insulted Rosie O'Donnell and that was bad, and that you had a bad legacy of insulting women and all this?
Right.
And then they went crazy. The magazines went crazy because they put her on all this, and I didn't know who she was because I don't get Fox News. Still don't get Fox News. But and then I thought there was something kind of phony here about her, but I kind of was interested. My friend Adam, who's been on the air here a few times, he got this at a book remainder, or the Burnaby Friends of the Richmond book thing.
Right.
And he got this at the end of 2016. It already was a discard, because this was a 2016 book, and this was before Trump won the election.
Right. So you're going to be talking about Megyn Kelly and Trump.
And maybe have a comment by her, if we can arrange that, about how she's thinking now.
So all week, the U.S. has been, and particularly Trump has been voicing their desire and intention to do something to take over Greenland, which is, in fact, part of the Kingdom of Denmark and an autonomous region, primarily populated by Inuit, because of their sort of, because it is primarily an Inuit area, not necessarily culturally Dane, it is an autonomous region within, self-governing autonomous region within the state of Denmark. Now, Denmark is also a NATO ally, an ally of Canada within the NATO alliance, and of course an ally of the United States. And it's been quite a crazy week of listening to how Trump's desire for taking over Greenland is possibly, you know, creating a situation that would see the end of NATO, at least as we know it.
Yes. I don't know if you're waiting for me to say something.
Do you have a comment?
It's insanity. It's the other thing about it. He talks about security, and they need it for security. Well, that's within the alliance.
Well, that's the thing. You know, they talk about they need it for national security, but it is the sovereign territory of one of their strongest alliance partners, wrapped up within the NATO alliance. Plus, on top of that, in addition to being part of NATO, there's a bilateral agreement between Denmark on the U.S. and the U.S. that gives them sort of the permission or the right to set up.
Yes, as many military.
Military installations and stuff. And they've in the past had a small air base there. Now apparently it's just 150 troops in a listening post, a radar and listening post. But the idea that they can't deal with all their security concerns within the existing construct.
It's
insanity.
It is. And they said Harry Truman was the closest to the average man who ever became president. Donald Trump is closest to the average nitwit mind who's ever become president. Because it's like, I think Harry Truman at least had some sort of, maybe something above the average person in sort of his, how he thought. In general, in fact, before he became vice president, his job was to have was to make sure that the military spending was not going to be over the top and finding ways that there was maybe invalid military spending during World War II, which was sort of important because they only had so much to spend as such. You can figure, you won't have an infinite number of taxation. You can tax people. Mm-hmm. So that's what he had before he was appointed vice president. Yeah. Donald Trump just seems to be what, like a lot of, like a plumber may say, well, we should do this to fix this problem. And they don't really know anything about it. Yeah. He's at that level.
Well, one of the things I think, this shows, one of the latest developments in the news this morning, or maybe it was last night, was that Donald Trump had sent a letter to Norway saying, because a bunch of NATO countries, eight of them, have sent a small number of troops to Greenland, and Norway is one of those countries, saying that basically, because he didn't get the Nobel Prize, that he's no longer needing to make peace his priority. And then a whole bunch of other stuff about why the U.S. needs Greenland and everyone should back off. But what this really shows us more than anything is that there is no one in the White House or the U.S. government who has any ability to stop him from doing whatever he wants or counsels him with any impact to not do whatever comes to mind. Because this situation, every time he opens his mouth about it, he's damaging relationships with allies and partners, all for nothing that they're going to gain from a security perspective, because anything they need security-wise is already sort of dealt with within the alliance and agreements in place. And the only thing this really gets him is some sort of boon to his ego, because he has some idea that it will be his legacy that he expanded the size of the United States. Although I think his real legacy will have been, and will I think there'll be a lot of parts to it, will be how much he's damaged the United States and its long-term relationships and its position in the world by ultimately creating a situation where they have very few friends, and the friends I do have don't trust them.
The other thing about this is this going to be a state or a territory? He insulted Puerto Rico. There was some a comic at one of his rallies who equivalated Puerto Rico to garbage. And then the cover-up was like, oh, well, we sent all our garbage there or something. And it was obviously saying that they were garbage. And then Joe Biden, I mean, he kind of slightly mistook. He meant to say that you're garbage for saying they're garbage. And then Donald Trump said, oh, he's saying our supporters are garbage and I'm a garbage man. He had that little thing. So, I mean, that's the other thing. It's going to be a territory. They're going to give them 200,000. Are they going to become American citizens? See, he just glosses over all of that.
Will they have any, you know, rights as citizens? Will they get to vote for their own thing? Because, of course, you know, I suspect, and we got to finish this off really fast, though, but, you know, the Greenlanders have the ability to vote to be independent if they wanted, and so will they be given the opportunity to do that? I doubt it. Anyway, what a mess. We'll follow this in the news. Time to move on to our main segment for the show today. And this is, as I said earlier, part of a six-part series produced by the Sexual Violence Support and Prevention's Office here at SFU, with the support of CJSF Radio. This is called Healing. The series is called Healing Together. This first one, episode one, is Dahlia Israel.
Healing Together is a series of intimate and thoughtful conversations hosted by SFU alums Salome Mengo Morales, Ira Rishi, undergraduate student Kovo, and myself, Paola Quiroz Cruz, one of the educators at the Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office. Featuring guests from diverse professional and life experiences, these interviews explore how healing, while deeply personal, is also profoundly communal. Healing thrives when communities come together to create spaces, attitudes, and practices that support it. Join us as we listen, reflect, and reimagine healing as a shared responsibility. In this special episode highlighting SFU Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we learn from counselors, mental health professionals, academic, and educators who remind us that healing and justice can take many forms and that we all play a role in shaping spaces that support survivors. As Afro-American author Prentice Hemphill asks in their book, What It Takes to Heal, what would it do movements to our society and culture to have the principles of healing at the very center? And what does it do to have healing at the center of every structure and everything we create? In this first episode of our podcast series, Salome Mengo Morales, an SFU alumna, sits down with Dahlia Israel, Executive Director of Salal Sexual Violence Support Center, for a powerful conversation about the role of community in healing from sexualized violence. Together, they explore why creating time and spaciousness is essential for processing legacies of harm and how these practices support long-term resilience. Dahlia shares insights on the often overlooked dimensions of grief and spirituality, inviting listeners to consider how these elements can deepen healing. This episode offers thoughtful reflections drawn from Dahlia's and Salo's experience within the gender-based violence sector, emphasizing that healing is not a solitary journey but one rooted in connection and compassion. This conversation includes reference to sexualized violence. We encourage you to take care for yourself and reach out to support resources if needed.
Hello, everyone. My name is Salome Mengo Morales, one of your hosts for this series. I used to be a volunteer at SFU SVSPO until I graduated from SFU with a bachelor's degree in world literature and international studies. I am now currently working as a volunteer for Salal Sexual Violence Support Center, but I serve as a crisis line volunteer and provide support in group counseling sessions. In today's episode, I'm joined by Talia Israel. In 2003, after completing a bachelor's degree in women's studies with a focus on critical studies and sexuality from the University of British Columbia, Talia started working full-time in the Victim Service Program in WAVAL, now known as the Law Sexual Violence Support Center. Eventually joining the management team, Talia oversaw Salal's Victim Service Program and Educational Outreach Program for more than 7 years. And since 2019, Talia has been the executive director of Salal. Talia also presents regularly at many local professional development nights for teachers, social workers, counselors, and victim service workers about the best practices for responding to survivors of sexual assault. All this hard work and years of advocacy offers so much insight into how we can build communities that truly support healing. Together, we'll be exploring restorative justice in the role of healing. We're grateful to have Talia with us to share reflections and wisdom. Hello, Talia. I'm beyond honored to have you with us today, and thank you for us for joining us. Is there anything else you would like to add about yourself and all the beautiful work you do?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Salome. I guess one of the biggest pieces that influences my thinking around restorative ways and principles these days is being a mom. So I'll add that I am a mother and a daughter, and also identify as having intergenerational trauma in my family, and that I'm also a survivor.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I feel like also knowing your history as a survivor, like you're as a mother, as a daughter, mm-hmm. shows so much light into the work you do too. It comes from a different perspective too. It shows so much more power being part of the change too, no?
Yeah. Yeah. That was definitely what brought me to WAVA in 2002 as also a volunteer for sure.
I'm so glad you're here with us today, and thank you for sharing all that.
Yeah.
And I think we can start with our questions for today too, if you want. So starting with the first question and following this theme of the series about healing being both personal and collective, what does communal healing mean to you as a mm-hmm. survivor and as a professional too?
Yeah. So I feel like I have... lots to say about this, actually. I think that as far as the organization goes and as far as Salal goes, we always say that we both support survivors and also shift society. And I think that comes from the deep kind of knowing within our movement and the feminist movement that we stand on the shoulders of so many activists that have long told us that the personal is political. And so this idea that we can somehow separate our own experiences when we're in a professional setting or when we're offering services from the personal, which means our own personal work and our own personal lived experiences, is just really impossible. Yeah. And I also come from traditions that tell me that in order to heal the world, we also have to start with healing ourselves. So I think that when we talk about communal healing and what that means for me personally, what that does mean is that if we're not individually doing our own work to find out where our wounds are, how we've come to understand certain things about ourselves and about the world, that trying to make inroads to fix really complex social issues in the world will be impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with what you were saying too about how healing comes from within too. Mm-hmm. In order to heal others and to heal the world in a way, we need to find that, not even peace, but like find what's broken and embrace it to fix it or like heal
yes.
in yeah. a way. And I feel like yeah. even your work in Salal, and like I'm seeing that as a volunteer now too, being part of that community too, like as mm-hmm. survivors, they help us heal. at the same time as we are helping others here. Like, we can like be hand in hand with this work too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I do think that communities that are by and for, so having sexual assault centers, you know, as us as an example, be filled with the people who have experienced harm and who have started to do the work so that they're able to then go on and support other communities is some of the like richest and most beautiful work that can be done for sure.
Yeah, it is truly beautiful and healing. Honestly, it is.
Yeah.
And since you're talking about these spaces and the communal, and also Salal and your work in there, I'm thinking also what kind of spaces, maybe like physical, emotional, or even cultural, to have supported either your healing or the healing of those around you, the ones you work with. What are some practices, personal, cultural, creative, or spiritual, that you have seen be especially powerful in supporting healing from sexualized violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've learned over the years is that so many of us have been implicated by patriarchy in our spiritual spaces and or through colonization. And many of us have lost like really meaningful connections to spirit, and that tends to be left out of many of our healing practices in dominant culture, and for good reason, right? Like many people have been really harmed by dogma and colonization and patriarchy. But it is something that I've noticed over the years that needs to be attended to. And so I think that spaces that allow for people to have autonomy over their process and that are supported to tap into what their spirit needs. And that can look like a thousand different things, but just to be supported to go there, I think is such an important piece, because what I've witnessed over the 20 years of doing this work is that if you don't attend to spirit in your healing from sexual violence, things continue to maybe present themselves in a way that when you do include that spiritual work, can kind of soften some of the ways that triggers can happen and that sort of thing. And you can really build a foundation that allows for more, just like easier access to resilience, I think. And I want to say that I don't mean spiritual or spirit in the way that it's attached to religion in any way, but just that giving people an opportunity to explore that, I think, is a really important aspect. And I think that that can also be part of our physical experience as well, right? I think being supported to have different practices where you're able to be in touch with your body in whatever way that feels comfortable. And that might be that you're compartmentalizing or that you can't have communication with your body, but really being able in a supportive way to explore relationship with body after sexual violence, I think is another really important area.
Yeah, especially it's like that connection with ourselves too, right? With our own person too, getting back to who we were and who we are now.
Yeah. And I think for some folks who have been impacted by sexual harm earlier in their lives, I remember speaking with a residential school survivor about concepts of like going back, and they gifted me wisdom around, like, for some of us, there is no going back, right? It's just a reimagining of what could have been at a different point, right? And so, yeah, sometimes it might be too much to be in your body, but it's also really important data and knowledge for us to hold that it is too much, right? And being offered the opportunity to explore those things, I think is, again, just like a really important part I know as a survivor myself, I lived in my head, and I often still find myself living in my head a lot. And there's good reason for that, right? Sometimes it's too much to inhabit our bodies in ways that don't feel good or safe. But it's also really good data about how we're doing and what might be emerging for us and where we might need more healing or more attention.
Yeah.
And then, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, that way you were talking about the spiritual to not being like in a religious, maybe like a conventional way of the world. It's also like understanding, going in introspective with ourselves and understanding what we really need, what our body is asking for, what our mind is asking for too.
Yeah, absolutely. And what our heart needs, you know, I think so much of healing from sexual violence is also grieving. Mm-hmm. And we don't often talk about grief in relation to sexual violence, but many of us have to give up communities or relationships or a particular way that we liked engaging in our body or went to go to certain places within our cities or towns. There's usually something that we need to change or that shifts, and allowing for that grieving process really does, affect our spirit in really important ways.
Yeah. And I feel like all you're saying too, I guess, like, it comes from like years too of like not only working, but like a survival, like experiencing life from a new point of view too. Mm-hmm. So I would like to know, how was your own understanding of healing evolve over time, especially working like so closely with survivors and community movements? And there are any moments that help you reframe what healing looks like, either personally or collectively?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think we're all kind of taught to think about healing. Well, maybe not all of us, but I think in my generation, like, I'm, you know, in my mid to late 40s. And I feel like when I was growing up, when I was a teenager, lots of people talked to us about like healing as a linear concept. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've learned a lot over time, and I think particularly from recovery communities, that just an acknowledgement that things happen in our lives and they become, that the goal often is to have those things become chapters in our books instead of the title of our book.
Yeah.
But to let go of the idea that healing means that we're going to return to something, or that we are never going to live through those things that we've experienced again, right? That somehow that triggers are not going to be something that live within us or alongside of us forever. But really learning how to be in relationship with those things. And I think that really changed for me, both how I experienced when things kind of reemerged for me, or I experienced triggers, and that it didn't instantly kind of shift me into like a disappointed place, like I was losing ground or that something wasn't working, but instead really started to be able to see that those pieces that reemerged as data. So as information that helped me then track, okay, this thing happened and I can understand my feelings to that in this particular way, which also supported me to be like kinder and more compassionate to myself and people around me, but also just like gave me really good insight into what might be coming up, and not just feel like overwhelmed and disappointed that it felt like a backslide or,
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it links with this idea that like healing is not linear too.
Yes.
Like our mind will give us more information depending on like where we are at that point too.
Maybe
right now we are exposed to a little bit of the trauma we went through, and a couple of years it may reemerge with like new information in our brain too. Like, okay, now you're ready to deal with this other part too.
Yeah.
So it's understanding that like those moments come and go too. And it's an ongoing progress and an ongoing work, individual work that we have to do with our minds too.
Yeah, absolutely.